raiders were fleeing. He followed it to the roof of the stadium and waited to see if the Garog was following. It was, using its arms to drag itself higher and kicking out with its legs to gain extra thrust. Through deep rents in the stone floor of the stadium, Starkiller could see the open air below. He ran from the ramp onto the roof. The Garog followed without hesitation, shouldering through an opening barely wide enough for its arm, let alone the rest of its body. It blinked in the daylight. All the lights and buzz of the suspended city meant nothing to it when its quarry stood just out of reach, tantalizingly still. It lunged and missed. Lunged and missed. It didn't care what damage it caused. Metal supports bent. Guy wires snapped and whipped away. A handful of jetpack-equipped stormtroopers buzzed about its head, trying to bring it back under control. But it had eyes only for Starkiller. He led it halfway around the arena before he felt the first lurching from below. A number of supports and stanchions were broken, ruining the integrity of the entire arena. The Garog just kept on coming. Only when they had returned almost to their point of origin did it seem to notice the way the surface beneath it was sinking, beginning to drop. The broad disc of the arena roof shuddered. Starkiller jumped to the only structure still attached to the city above, the skybox, from which the potentate, he assumed, had enjoyed the best possible view. He landed on the roof just as the last support for the arena gave way and began the long tumble to the sinkhole below. The Garog howled as it too began to fall. Starkiller cut a hole in the roof of the skybox and jumped nimbly inside. There he found the potentate standing his ground in front of an ornate gold throne. A half-circle of slain Nymordian aides lay at his feet. He held his blaster on Coda, who was approaching with lightsaber at the ready, unhindered at all by either fatigue or blindness. Starkiller's arrival distracted the potentate, who snapped a quick shot at him, easily deflected. Before Coda could strike, settling the score for a week of endless slaughter, the whole skybox lurched, sending all three of them flying. Metal squealed. Transparent steel shattered. The roar of the Garog filled the air. Starkiller clutched a console as the skybox lurched again, tipping the floor steadily closer to vertical.
"You fool!"
cried the potentate, spread eagle on the floor.
"You've killed us all!"
Starkiller peered warily out the nearest window. It was immediately clear what had happened. The Garog had arrested its fall by catching hold of the skybox with one hand, and now it was trying to climb to safety. In doing so, however, it was steadily destroying the skybox itself. The gold throne broke free from its restraints and slid toward the shattered viewport. It scooped up the potentate as it went, dragging him down with its considerable mass. He clutched at the floor, but could do nothing to arrest his fall. He screamed as he went out the window and fell straight into the Garog's gaping mouth. The tiny meal galvanized what was left of the Garog's facility to reason. It looked up into the skybox, seeing it for the first time as a container, not simply something to hang on to. It saw the shining of the energy weapons that had stung it. With its free hand, it lunged for them, but succeeded only in bringing down still more of the structure. There was no way now to avoid falling. It knew that in the depths of its deranged mind. With the last of its strength, it lunged again and caught its enemy at last.
"Coda!"
Starkiller shouted as the Garog ripped the Jedi General from the skybox and dragged him down with it.
"Turn away, boy!"
he heard Coda saying in his mind.
"Get on with your mission! There are some things you aren't ready to face!"
He blinked. The words were another memory, not an instruction from the falling general. He wasn't going to take orders from the past, especially when he hadn't followed them the first time around. There's nothing I can't face, Starkiller thought. He let go of the console and took a running jump through the shattered window. It was surprising just how far the Gorok had already fallen toward the gaping mouth of the sinkhole, but he refused to be discouraged. He dived in a straight line, using the force to propel him through the whipping wind. He remembered, with perfect clarity, his former self's plummet to the surface of the incomplete Death Star, and hard on the heels of that memory came the sensation of Juno's lips against his. Longing for her filled him, driving him downward even faster. The stench of the Gorog's fear and rage came heavily on the air as he approached it. The beast was tumbling. The fist containing Kota flashed once in front of him, then a second time. The general was slashing at the fingers holding him pinned, to little effect. Starkiller had to get him free before Kota's strength gave out, and he was crushed to a pulp. Selecting his point of landing with as much care as he was able, Starkiller came down on the creature's back, close enough to one of the duranium anchors to take hold of it. He braced himself with both feet against the spine, ignoring the way the world was spinning around him. The Gorog didn't know he was there. It wouldn't be expecting an attack from this side. He took a deep breath, reaching deeper into the force than he had before. He had never journeyed to the center of a planet, where the molten metal raged and burned under pressure hard enough to make a diamond out of dust, but he imagined something much like that. This time, he wanted to do more than just enrage the Gorok. He could feel the web of veins thudding a panicky beat beneath the skin. He concentrated on that beat, on the rapid pulsing of life that would be extinguished when it reached the bottom of the sinkhole. Why wait that long when Kota's life was at stake as well? For a moment, he faltered. He'd never killed anything this big before, but it was just one life, and it stood between him and his goal. He had no choice. Instead of a wild crackle of lightning, he discharged a single pure bolt into the metal anchor, stabbing deep through the creature's chest into its heart. Its back arched. A strange fluting cry emerged from its mouth. Starkiller rode out the spasm, maintaining the electric shock for as long as he was able. Muscular waves rolled back and forth, twisting him from side to side. It felt like a ground quake, a flesh quake on a planet-sized monster. The pulsing coming through the soles of his boots ran wild, faltered, ceased. He sagged as the mountain of flesh finally grew still. The fight was over, but darkness enfolded them as they entered the mouth of the sinkhole and went into free fall. Starkiller used rough pits in the creature's skin to pull himself up to the shoulder, then down the limp arm that had held Kota captive. The general was clinging to the slackened thumb, head cocked, as though he could see the sinkhole wall sliding by. He shouted a greeting over the sound of the rushing wind.
I hope you've got a way out of this, boy!
Starkiller put an arm around Kota's shoulders. Together, they leapt off the Gorog's hand. Starkiller could slow their fall somewhat, but he couldn't fly. The beast fell ahead of them. Maybe, he hoped against hope, it would go some way toward arresting their impact.
If you're wearing a comlink, Kota said, hand it over!
Starkiller did so, even though that was as faint a hope as his own.
The whole city's jammed!
Kota punched keys on the comlink.
Let's hope she can reach us in time!
Starkiller's heart quickened. She? He glanced down into the shadow, wondering how deep the sinkhole could possibly be. Above, he saw only the shrinking circle of cityscape. He stared until it was occluded by something solid. He thought he recognized the silhouette. The roar of a starship's engines echoed down the sinkhole as the familiar angles and planes of the rogue shadow dived down toward them and then overtook them so it could intercept them from below. Though Starkiller pushed down against the starship's hull with the force to cushion their fall, they still hit the surface hard. Starkiller blinked away stars and groaned under the return of gravity. Coda was faring no better, clutching his shoulder and struggling to sit up. A hatch popped open nearby, and the old man waved the younger man ahead of him. Starkiller was already moving. His entire being thrilled at the certainty that Juno was here at last. He could practically see her already, waiting at the controls for him to arrive, ready with some quip about being late to his own funeral. He dropped down through the hatch and ran breathlessly to the cockpit.
Juno!
He stopped dead. The cockpit was empty. All he heard in reply was a ghost of her voice, speaking from the depths of his memory. Please, don't make me leave another life behind. Chapter 6. One day earlier. Juno took one last look at the fluted domes of Hyorkia, a floating city, before diving under the waves. Its shell-like buildings gleamed red and gold by the light of Mon Calamari's systems primary, looking more like something grown than built, much like the coral of Mester Reef beneath her. None of the reef protruded above the water, and she was submerged up to her waist, buffeted by the alien sea as she stared at the city. She wanted something beautiful to hold in her mind before entrusting her life to air that stank of rotten rubber. Akbar ducked under without hesitation, followed a second later by Bail Organa, who had donned an old clone subtrooper breathing apparatus like hers. In a wetsuit and mismatching white helmet, he looked about as ridiculous as Juno felt. For the first time, she didn't worry that her weapons would be sealed in their packs until they emerged at the other end. If anyone saw them climbing out of the water at the far end, they would certainly not regard them as any kind of threat. The Quarren were already underwater. Holding her breath instinctively, Juno took a single step forward, off the rough coral surface, and let herself sink into the water. It was blue and clearer than she'd expected. The cargo freighter was moored safely out of sight at the base of the reef. Guided there by remote control, once the 10 conspirators had disembarked, she could see its featureless nose almost as though through air. She couldn't, however, see their destination. Trusting to the Quarren's sense of direction, she followed strongly kicking feet around the bulk of the reef and into the open ocean. Proxy took the shape of Segor Tell's, using repulsors to swim rather than sink straight to the bottom. Juno kept careful track of which Tell's was which, just in case. Strong currents favored them half the way, then shifted direction as the seabed drew nearer, making progress much more difficult. Hyorkia was a true floating city, with no structural connections to the bedrock, but several chunky cables did run from its undulating base down into the sludge. Ferrying waste one way and geothermal power another, she guessed, but just then wasn't the time to wonder about the city's inner workings. As its underside came into view, she kept her eyes open for the vent Tells had described. Proxy had sliced into plans of the city and confirmed that it was still there. The vent had been sealed up early in the Imperial occupation of the city, but laser-cutting equipment designed for underwater use would make short work of that obstacle. There, a dark patch against the city's white underbelly. She waved to catch the others' attention and pointed. She could have used the subtrooper gear's comlink, but they were maintaining strict radio silence. White light flared as one of Sirik's apprentices activated the cutting equipment. bubbles of steam spread upward and flattened out against the city's hull, forming rippling streams and threads. Juno waited for lights to flash and alarms to sound, but nothing happened. The Imperials had clearly grown complacent about security, at least in this damp corner of the galaxy. With one last flash, the white light died. The grill fell out in a single circular piece and dropped to the ocean floor far below. Tells went through first, staying carefully clear of the still hot metal. His feet disappeared. A minute later, his hand reappeared, giving a definite thumbs up. One by one, the rest of the team followed him into the pipe. Juno swam 10 meters to a ladder that led up to a level deck. There the water was below knee height, and the atmosphere was breathable. She gratefully dispensed with the breathing apparatus and took in a chestful of sweet, if slightly scum-tainted, natural air. The deck was illuminated by faint downlights that flickered weakly with age. It didn't look as if anyone had visited that level in at least a decade. Still, she moved as quietly as she could to a higher section, where the way was completely dry. There she slipped off the wetsuit and straightened the flight uniform she'd been wearing beneath. Proxy flickered back to his usual form and followed her, yellow eyes flickering in the dim light. "Are you feeling all right?" she asked the droid. Apart from an occasional flutter, his chameleon circuit remained stable. But he had hardly spoken since his awakening. "Is there something I should worry about?"
"Oh no, Juno. I am simply processing my lack of a viable primary program."
"Does it seriously impair your function?" she asked, wondering if she had made a mistake involving Proxy in the mission.
"No, but it does concern me. I have been deactivated twice since Raxus Prime, and each time it seems a miracle that I have returned. Who am I, if not my primary program? What am I, if I have no reason to function?"
That seemed a very human concern, and one that had no easy answer. "I guess you're just you," she said, "and you seem okay to me."
"Thank you, Captain Eclipse. That is of some small reassurance."
Every being is the sum of its experiences and actions. Put in Bail Organa, coming up alongside them and dropping his discarded wetsuit next to Juno's. "Sometimes we don't know what our primary program is, or was, until we've lived long enough to look back at our lives."
"I'm afraid I do not understand how to function under such circumstances. Droids are not designed to program themselves."
"I'm sorry, Proxy," Juno said with real feeling. "I didn't realize you felt so strongly about this. Do you wish I hadn't woken you up this time?"
"Not at all, Captain Eclipse. I am glad to be in the world again, and I remain optimistic that I will be assigned a new primary program one day. I cannot be the only example of my class in operation."
Juno wasn't so sure of that. She'd never seen a droid like him before, and assumed that he was something Darth Vader had commissioned years ago to act as plaything and tutor to his young apprentice. The thought of Starkiller darkened her mood. Why was she thinking about him so much? Sometimes she wished her primary program could be changed as easily as a droid's. It would certainly save her a whole lot of grief. When the Quarren were ready, they gathered at the top of the ramp, where a corridor led off into two opposite directions.
"This is where we split up," said Akbar. "Siddiq, you know what to do."
The bomb expert and his assistants patted their waterproof packs and nodded.
"All right. Good luck. Make your move on Segor's signal."
The five headed off into the gloomy distance, feet slapping softly against the floor. Akbar guided Juno, Organa, Proxy, and Segor Tells up the other way. They moved silently, conscious of the fact that the city was entirely in Imperial hands. They could trust no one, and carried blasters openly, in case they happened across anyone so deep in the basements. Around them, the city hummed and shifted on the surface of the endless sea. There was no sense of motion, just a constant creaking and groaning of welds. Juno wondered if any of these floating cities ever sprang a leak, but didn't think right then the time to ask. That was the least of their problems. Akbar and Tel swapped positions when they reached the upper levels. The Quarren had the codes for the fighter wing's secure compound, obtained, he said, by bribing a maintenance team who had worked briefly for the city's administration. Tells padded softly ahead of them, moving with stealthy confidence along the metallic corridors. If he was nervous, it didn't show. They reached the checkpoint, one of seven scattered across the city. This was the least frequented, but still under heavy guard. Seven stormtroopers patrolled the area, keeping a close eye on anyone who approached. "Your turn to shine, Proxy," Juno said. "You've assimilated the Imperial files." The droid's holographic generators flickered and flashed, hiding his true appearance behind another. That of a rotund, balding, white human male, dressed in an Imperial uniform.
"Yes, Captain Eclipse."
His voice changed too, to match that of the fighter wing's commander.
"If you will follow me..."
"Sorry about this,"
whispered Juno to Akbar as she aimed her blaster at him. Organa did the same for Tells. "You know it's just for show."
"No hard feelings,"
said Akbar, slipping his own blaster out of sight. Proxy strode confidently into view, leading the two humans and their DAC native captives to the checkpoint. The guards looked up as they approached and stood to attention.
"Commander Darrakot."
"Indeed,"
said Proxy, not breaking step. The trooper who had spoken raised a hand.
"I'm sorry, sir. I just need to record your companions."
"Of course. Two informants and two members of the DAC Resistance for urgent interrogation. I have reason to believe that an attack is imminent."
The troopers exchanged nervous glances.
"Security codes?" asked the squad leader.
Juno hid her anxiety. Why was a stormtrooper asking the flight wing commander for security codes? Something was going wrong. She tightened her grip on her blaster.
20-35-19-67,
said Proxy without hesitation, quoting the information he had sliced from the Imperial network.
"Thank you, sir. Move along."
The troopers parted ranks, allowing the group of five an unobstructed path through the checkpoint. Juno held her breath as she passed between the troopers. All it would take now was for Proxy's holographic impersonation to flicker and the ruse would be exposed.
"Commander Darrakot, hold a moment."
Proxy stopped in mid-stride but didn't turn.
"What now? Can't you see I'm in a hurry?"
Juno didn't learn what had made the trooper suspicious. A bail of blaster fire from Bail Organa caught him in the throat, throwing him backward. A second bolt took out the trooper closest to him, and a third spun the next one along in a circle. The speed and accuracy of the three shots was as impressive as they were unexpected. She took two shots of her own as the opposing group scattered, leaving just four troopers to return fire. Bolts of energy flashed back and forth. Small explosions threw fragments of plastoid from the walls and ceiling. Smoke thickened the air, made her eyes water. It didn't last long. Akbar and Tells took out three of the remaining troopers, and the last soon keeled face forward across one of his compatriots, hit by Juno and Organa from two sides at once.
"Nice shooting,"
Juno told the senator as she emerged from cover. The compliment was sincerely meant. Shot for shot, he was both faster and more accurate than she was.
"I'm a little out of practice," he said,
checking up and down the corridor for signs the ruckus had been noticed.
"You should have seen me during my academy days."
They dragged the bodies into a storage locker. With luck, no one would notice the breach in security before their mission was complete. Proxy maintained the illusion of Commander Derricotte as they resumed their hasty march into the secure compound. It was more crowded than the city proper had been. Droids and techs hurried through the corridors, but thankfully, no more troopers. They received the odd askance look, and Juno wondered why. What about Proxy's impersonation didn't ring true? When they reached the flight wing's empty barracks, she began to understand what Proxy had got wrong. "It's filthy in here," she said, staring at the messily draped uniforms and unpolished boots. Weapons parts lay on bunks next to scattered rations. Because grunts took their lead from the superior officer, she had no doubt that this reflected the real Derricotte through and through. "Who are these guys?"
"I don't know," Organa said. "But we have to hurry. The briefing starts in 10 minutes.
They found a passerby and grilled him on the whereabouts of the real commander.
"In the nursery," stammered the tech. "They have kids here?"
Juno's sense of outrage reached a new peak. She would never have allowed such laxity under her command.
"For his plans," the tech managed to get out. "The nursery's what he calls the greenhouse."
When he had provided directions, Organa knocked him out with a deft tap to the back of the skull. "Tels and I will deal with the commander," he told Juno. "You and Akbar go with Proxy to the briefing. Make it convincing."
"We'll do our best," Juno said, even as one growing doubt niggled at her. If Derricotte was as slovenly as his pilots, that had to be what was giving them away.
They split up. Hurrying to the briefing room with Akbar, she directed Proxy to look more like the real Derricotte did. She hoped.
"Undo another button, loosen the collar, roll up the sleeves, too, and mess the hair more."
"Are you sure this is an improvement, Captain Eclipse?"
the droid asked her.
"As sure as I can be, Proxy. Let's keep our fingers crossed."
There was no guard at the briefing room entrance. Akbar and Juno slipped to the back of the room as Proxy strode to the podium at the front. Pilots slouched in their seats and didn't rise to attention when their commander entered. Although she had left the Empire more than a year ago, Juno's blood still boiled. These guys were giving pilots everywhere a bad name. No one looked twice at Proxy's modified disguise. His preamble was brief.
"Forget the flight schedule you already have," he said. "I'm giving you a new assignment. Practicing honor rolls over the city. All of you."
There were groans from pilots who had only just come off an active shift.
"Is this something to do with the shuttle that arrived last night?" asked one.
"That is classified," said Proxy without missing a beat. "I want you in the air in 5 standard minutes. Dismissed."
The pilots complained and griped, but slowly began to move. Some even managed a semblance of urgency. 5 minutes would have been a very quick turnaround, even for a well-practiced flight wing. Juno wouldn't have put a credit on this lot making 10, maybe not even 15. Still, time was tight for the conspirators to get to where they needed to be next.
"Good work, Proxy,"
Akbar told him when the room was clear.
"Now back to the rendezvous point."
They retraced their steps through the secure compound, past the still unnoticed checkpoint and into the city proper, where Proxy returned to his normal appearance. No alarm sounded. No shots rang out. Everything appeared to be going according to plan, so far. The 5 Quarren were waiting for them in the shadowy lower levels, rehydrating themselves in the rippling water. They communicated by hand signals that the charges were laid and the trigger set exactly as required.
So far, thought Juno, so good. "Bail and Tell should have been here by now," she said, checking her chrono and counting off the minutes.
The TIE fighters of the 181st would be in the air soon, even by her most conservative estimate.
"Search for them in the city security grid, Proxy.
Maybe they've been picked up somewhere.
No need,
called the senator himself from the top of the ramp. He jogged down to meet them with Tells in his wake, pushing their prisoner ahead of them.
Sorry to hold you up. Our friend here moves more slowly than we planned for.
What is the meaning of this?
Blustered the real Ever Derricott, commander of the 181st Fighter Wing. He looked even scruffier than Proxy had portrayed him, although perhaps that was a result of his capture.
You'll never get away with it.
Take those binders off him,
said Akbar, when the commander was before him.
We have a message for the Emperor. Get off deck and stay away from the Mon Calamari system. Oh,
something moved in the shadows. Akbar reached for his blaster and so did Juno. The Quarren huddled in closer to one another.
Who's there?
Called Organa.
Come out!
I think they've said enough,
called a voice.
Take them.
It's a trap!
Gasped Akbar. Two dozen stormtroopers stepped into the light, weapons trained on the knot of conspirators they encircled. At their head stood a tall, thin man in the uniform of a senior officer in the Imperial administration. So senior, in fact, that she had never seen the insignia in person before. He had a nose like a knife blade, and eyes to match, and his cruel mouth was practically lipless. It was clear that Akbar knew him. He instantly raised his blaster to shoot at him, but a well-timed blaster bolt from one of the troopers knocked the weapon from his hand.
There's no point resisting, Akbar,
said the stern figure in a chillingly polite voice, striding confidently toward them with his hands behind his back.
You're quite outnumbered.
Please drop your weapons, or I will have you executed right here. All except you, Akbar. I'm looking forward to having you back in my employ. That'll remind my other slaves that escape is simply not an option. Akbar's mottled skin had turned a sickly yellow.
I will never be your slave again, Tarkin. Never.
Grand Moff Wilhuff Tarkin smiled coldly.
That choice is now well and truly out of your hands.
Derricott pulled free, rubbing his wrists.
Thank you, Grand Moff. Thank you for rescuing me.
I won't say it was my priority, but I will accept your gratitude. Be careful it doesn't happen again.
Tarkin turned to face Bail Organa.
Your weapon, Senator. I asked you to drop it.
Organa obeyed, and so did the others, all except Tells. His gun remained in his hand, and none of the Imperials moved to force the issue. Slowly, without saying a word, he walked to join their numbers.
Why?
Akbar asked him.
Once a traitor, always a traitor,
answered Tarkin for him, with a gloating tut-tut.
You rebels should choose your friends more carefully. He contacted me a day ago, offering to return my slave in exchange for greater freedoms for his people and a place in the civil administration. He won't get either, of course. I am not known for changing my mind, particularly when it comes to negotiating with aliens.
It was Tell's turn to go pale.
You mean you...
Yes, put your blaster down and stand with the others, while I decide if you're important enough for the Emperor to kill himself, or whether I should just dispose of you now. I'm leaning toward the latter, simply to spare the mess.
At that moment, a series of explosions rocked the city. The floor moved beneath them.
What's that?
Asked Tarkin of his nearest trooper.
Find out.
Another trio of blasts brought part of the ceiling down. Tells raised his blaster and fired at the lights, extinguishing them. Utter darkness instantly fell. In the confusion, Juno dived for her blaster. She heard a stormtrooper say,
It's the 181st, sir. They're firing on the city.
Impossible!
Blubbered Derricott.
I gave no such order. To me!
Tarkin ordered his men from the ramp.
To me!
Juno fired in the direction his voice had come from. Her shot went wide, revealing his high-cheeked visage in the flash. She rolled before the stormtroopers could return fire. Soon the space was a maelstrom of light and sound as more explosions rocked the city, one after the other, and the two sides exchanged blaster fire. She found Organa and stood with her back to him, admiring the elegant precision of his shots. When he fired, he nearly always hit, even in the dark. The stormtroopers retreated up the ramp, following the voice of the Grand Moff. Juno and the others stayed exactly where they were, waiting for the echoes of the last explosion to fade away. When it did, there was blessed silence, apart from the tinkling of debris and the lapping of water. A torch flared, held high in Akbar's hand.
Are we all here?
Juno took a quick head count. Everyone was accounted for, except Proxy and one of Sirik's assistants, who'd been hit in the chest by a stray shot. Organa found Derekat huddling in a ball in the corner of the room with his hands over his head. He didn't seem to notice that the firing had ceased until the senator pulled him upright, blinking and fearful. There was no sign of Tarkin.
He must have slipped away in the skirmish,
said Akbar, looking disappointed.
Never mind, said Organa, patting his shoulder. That we almost got him sends the same message.
And we still have this one,
said Tells, squeezing Derekat's face between his long fingers and peering close.
For what he's worth.
You mean you're not...
stammered the flight wing commander, looking from face to face in confusion.
And you are...
all on the same side, yes,
the Quarren said.
Thanks for your help.
But I didn't...
Juno almost felt sorry for him. Explosions, timed to coincide with the honor roll you didn't order. It won't fool anyone for long, but it had exactly the right effect in the moment. Don't you think? Footsteps sounded on the ramp above. They looked up to see Proxy returning. The Tarkin disguise he'd adopted during the battle, slipping away with an electric crackle.
I led the troopers in the opposite direction to the real Grand Moff. They are currently on their way to the landing pads, with orders to arrest the pilots responsible.
Good work, Proxy. It went almost perfectly. Derekat stared at the droid in shock, clearly beginning to piece events together.
What are you going to do with me?
He asked.
Nothing,
said Akbar. His eyes narrowed.
Nothing?
Tarkin will accept your explanation, Organa explained. But I'd say your career is pretty much ruined here regardless. Grand Moffs don't like inferiors who draw attention to themselves. You might want to pull your head in for a while, if you still have one. The senator released him, and Derekat stepped slowly away, as though expecting to be shot at any moment.
You're really letting me go?
Yes, said Akbar. You are a witness to what happens when one interferes with the Dark Resistance.
The commander was too busy hurrying up the ramp to promise anything, but Juno didn't doubt that the message would get out. With one short action, the Empire had been humiliated, and the local resistance strengthened. It was the very embodiment of Coda's methods. Juno wondered if Mon Mothma would see it that way, when she found out. When they were alone, Organa put one hand on Tell's shoulder, the other on Akbar's. I don't think I need to say anything, he said, echoing Garm Bel Iblis's philosophy. Actions speak louder than words.
In this case, yes,
said Tells, tentacles curling tightly in gratitude.
Thank you, from the free people of our world, for showing us that we can fight together. and must fight together in order to remove the Emperor's net from our world. We will join your rebellion as one world, in the spirit you have shown us.
Does he speak for you too, Akbar?
You know he does, my friend. And I thank you too.
Akbar's large golden eyes took in Juno and Proxy.
We owe your Rebel Alliance much already.
It's not ours, said Organa, and for a moment Juno feared that he would declare it to be Starkiller's, as Kota had in Felucia once. The rebellion can't belong to any one person, or it's no better than the Empire. It's yours. Everyone's. It belongs to all of us.
Our dead, too,
said Tells, acknowledging the body his fellows had lifted in preparation for leaving the city.
We have lost so many already.
They stood in silence for a moment, Juno thinking of Kota and Starkiller, and wondering what they would make of this strange moment of communion among three species in a waterlogged basement. There was no way of knowing now. No way at all.
Part 2. Revelation. Chapter 7. The same day.
Where is she? Kota stumbled into the cockpit behind him. He was covered in blood and dirt and looked on the verge of collapse. Starkiller didn't care.
Where is she?
I don't know.
Why not? This is her ship.
It was. It isn't now. She's moved on.
Kota slumped into the nearest seat and put his scarred face in his hands.
The Rebel Alliance fleet is scattered across the Outer Rim. Constantly on the run. She could be anywhere now.
Starkiller frowned. It just didn't make sense. She wasn't with you when you came here?
She was, but I had my own squad on the ground.
Kota's blind eyes came up.
All dead now, of course. I was the only one Baron Tarko spared when he captured us. The ship went into hiding, awaiting my signal. Then you came.
Thank you. The last was said with great gravity and sincerity.
I don't know how much longer I would have lasted.
Starkiller dismissed that with a wave of one hand and checked the controls. Now that his anticipation at seeing Juno had been punctured, more mundane concerns took priority, like making sure the ship wasn't being followed by any of the deceased Baron's underlings. The rogue shadow had brought itself out of the sinkhole and was heading for orbit, where it would await further orders. He didn't know what those orders should be now, and he wasn't ready to take the empty seat at the controls where Juno should have been sitting.
Should have been in his previous life, but now Kota had his own squad, and Juno had moved on, whatever that meant.
Things had changed in ways he had never considered.
Tell me exactly what happened.
The general related the circumstances of his capture with his usual economy. An unofficial raid on a local despot had gone unexpectedly wrong, thanks to bad intel regarding the size and capabilities of the forces on Cairo Nymoidia. Under other circumstances, that might not have been the complete disaster it had very nearly turned out to be, but with no backup to speak of, apart from a small frigate in orbit, there had been no second chance for Kota and his squad.
She tried her best, Kota concluded, and I don't blame her for leaving. She couldn't take on the entire Empire herself, although I'm sure she wanted to.
She was here?
Kota nodded. She was the captain of the frigate.
Mon Mothma recognizes talent, even if she won't always put it to good use. He leaned forward excitedly.
But now you're back, and she will have to see what an opportunity this represents.
We must capitalize on it immediately. A major strike to take the fight back to the Empire.
Wait.
The return of Coda's vigor took Starkiller by surprise. One moment he was half dead. The next, he wanted to wage war on the entire galaxy, with Starkiller leading the charge. Coda's faith in him was touching, but it needed to be tempered with a little reality. Don't you want to know where I came from? Why? You're back, that's all that counts. But I'm not back. I'm not him. Coda shook his head emphatically. I may be blind, but I'm still connected to the Force. I know what I'm sensing. I'm not Starkiller! It was vitally important that Coda understand that much, at least. The General wasn't his master, and couldn't be, until he was certain who he was. They couldn't just pick up where they'd left off. Not the original Starkiller, anyway. I'm a clone, grown in a vat by Darth Vader to take the old Starkiller's place at his side. That should worry you, shouldn't it? Coda leaned forward and scratched at his filthy beard. I figure I already know the worst you can do, he said, tapping the corner of one dead eye. But I've experienced the best, too. So I'm prepared to take my chances. Starkiller backed down, wondering if Coda was referring to his blinding alone or to something much worse. You should know that Shakti is dead, he heard Bail Organa say out of the past. She was murdered by Vader, or one of his assassins. Probably the same one who did this to me, Coda had replied, making much the same gesture Coda had in the present. The guess had been correct, but had Juno told him? Had he furthermore connected Shakti's death to the disappearance of Kazdan Paratus, whom Starkiller had also murdered? Coda had forgiven Starkiller for blinding him. But the deaths of two Jedi, one of them a former Jedi Master on the High Council, were an entirely different magnitude of guilt. Could such a thing ever truly be forgiven? Light. Dark. Shakti had said. They are just directions. Do not be fooled that you stand on anything other than your own 2 feet. Even from the grave, she had something to teach him, as Coda had taught him in life. He was no longer a creature of the dark side or the light side. The only direction he cared about was the one leading to Juno, where his emotions led him. Kazdan Paratus, moldering on Raxus Prime in his junkyard version of a living death, was another educative example for him, courtesy of one of his victims. If he were to avoid living entirely in the past, he would have to focus on what really mattered. Help me find Juno. That's all I'm asking you to do. Coda studied him with senses that had nothing to do with his eyes. Head for a Thega system, the General finally said. That was the last rendezvous point. When we get there, maybe we'll find some hint of where they've gone. They could still be there now, couldn't they? Coda shook his head. If there was any chance I or one of my squad could have survived, the fleet would have had to move. Even Mon Mothma would see the sense in that. That was the second time Coda had downplayed Mon Mothma's role in the Rebel Alliance. Starkiller filed it away for future consideration. I'm going to the fresher, Coda said as Starkiller turned to the controls and began plotting the jump. And then I'm going to sleep. Wake me when we get there. All right. Coda paused on the brink of leaving the bridge. I'm glad you're back, boy. Before Starkiller could say he's not, the General turned and limped away. The Rogue Shadow had been modified since he had last flown it, and not entirely for the better. Its shielding was heavier, giving it a different feel when under thrust, and some of the compartments had been expanded to make room for Coda's squad. That left several critical components crushed uncomfortably together, at constant risk of overheating. Starkiller kept a constant eye on the instruments as the ship jumped through hyperspace, waiting for a warning light to flash. Amazingly, none did. Whoever had rejigged the systems had made absolutely sure to push the envelope, but never cross it. Someone with extensive battlefield engineering experience was responsible, he suspected. He also assumed they had died with Coda's squad on Cato Nymoidia, so he would never be able to ask how they'd done it. Ultimately, it didn't matter. They were underway, and that was the main thing. He had time to think, too, although that wasn't necessarily something he welcomed. His brief exchange with Kota had stirred up a whole raft of anxieties he hadn't even known he possessed. I've already seen the worst you can do. A major strike to take the fight back to the Empire. I'm glad you're back. He hadn't considered what might happen after finding Juno. Did the rest of the rebels know about Shakti and Kazdan Paratus? Had they forgiven him for the trap he had unwittingly set on Corellia? Would the stain of Darth Vader's mastery ever wash off him?
He stinks of Sith, all right,
Kazdan Paratus had said. You reek of that coward, Vader, Shakti had agreed. Only Kota had sensed the goodness within him. Did he really sense it now, or was that just blind hope speaking? Starkiller would have to wait until Kota woke up to ask him. The issue of what came next connected inevitably to what he had been created for. Until Vader had pushed him too far, he had assumed that his purpose was to serve at his former master's side, killing his enemies and possibly assisting him one day in making a grab for the Imperial throne. That was how he had been trained in his former life, after all, and it was easy to default to that status. But now, with his memories gradually piecing back together, and more of the former Starkiller's life becoming clearer, he began to question that assumption. Darth Vader had plans within plans, making them hard to unravel. Starkiller's first resurrection had been on the Empirical, after the Emperor had ordered Vader to kill his secret apprentice. The betrayal Starkiller had remembered on Kamino, when Vader had declared him a failure, fit for the same fate meted out to the others he had made. Starkiller remembered the almost blackness of something much like death, and then awakening on an operating table to receive new instructions. Vader said that he had faked Starkiller's death in order to make him a free agent, free to target the Emperor more directly. That had seemed plausible, for that was what Sith did, according to Shakti. Betray each other as a matter of course. But then, on Corellia, Vader had revealed that this had never been his plan, that his intention, the Emperor's intention, had been to use him to gather all the Empire's enemies into one spot in order to destroy them once and for all. And then, Vader had hinted, it would be time to take on the Emperor. But not with Starkiller.
I lied, as I have from the very beginning,
Vader had said. Vader always lied, Starkiller now realized, but somewhere underneath the lies, there had to be a measure of truth. A cloned Starkiller must serve some purpose, otherwise, why go to the trouble? Did he exist to continue one of Vader's previous plans, or an entirely new one? Was Vader still following the Emperor's orders, or was the Emperor's enforcer making it up as he went along? That didn't seem likely. One thing Starkiller did know was his former master's nature. Darth Vader was meticulous and controlling. He would leave nothing to chance. His motives and intentions might be hidden for the moment, but they would have to become visible sometime. Perhaps, with enough thought, the clone of his former apprentice might be the one to work it out. Without me, you'll never be free, he had told Vader on Corellia. On the Death Star, it had seemed that only death would release his master from servitude, for the Emperor himself had so thoroughly steeped Vader's mind in the dark side, and there had been a moment when the Dark Lord's life had literally been in Starkiller's hands. He could have released his master from a life of torment had he chosen vengeance over the lives of his friends among the rebels. If he hadn't, he might not have died and been reborn as a clone, or he might have died for good. He wasn't sure which would have been better.
"Do not forget that you still serve me,"
Darth Vader had said. In the back of his mind, ever present, was the fear that this would always be the case. That any semblance of freedom he might find would only be an illusion. That at any moment, his master would walk back into his life, as he had on Corellia, and destroy everything he had built. He swore to himself that it would never happen. He hoped it was a promise he could keep. And if only he could forget. His mind was full of so many things. The controls beeped at him. Time had passed with uncanny speed while he sat in silent contemplation. The rogue shadow was due to arrive in the Theka system at any moment. Starkiller thought about waking Coda, but decided to let him sleep. After fighting 7 days straight, the old man deserved his rest. The blue-white streaks of hyperspace vanished. Blinding yellow radiation took their place, making the ship shake. Starkiller's hands danced over the controls, raising shields and frantically scanning the environment. It felt as though he'd landed right in the middle of an explosion. But what could produce so much force without ebbing in intensity? This was no isolated blast. It was a sustained rage. The answer was simple. A sun. The sun at the center of a Theka system, to be precise. It was huge and highly active, throwing off corona loops longer than most ring systems and deeply pitted with sunspots. Hull temperature was rising fast. Even with the extra shielding, the rogue shadow wasn't going to last long. Sensors indicated two rocky planets. A cluster of small dots sheltered behind one of them. He grinned and punched in the coordinates as fast as he was able, assuming that he had indeed found the rebel fleet. The relative calm of hyperspace enfolded him. His ears rang in the sudden silence. He took a moment to catch his breath, while the ship ticked and pinged around him, slowly shedding its excess heat into the infinite vacuum of an empty universe. He eyed the countdown on the chrono, sure that conditions would be more temperate in the world shadow. Why else would the rebel fleet hide there? The hop was a short one. Barely a minute passed before the ship emerged from hyperspace again, and this time the ride was considerably smoother. The ship's shields were more than adequate to keep the worst at bay. He scanned the ships around him, hoping to find the frigate Coda had mentioned, the Salvation, Juno's ship. None of the transponders matched that name, however, and very quickly another hard fact became apparent. None of the ships belonged to the rebel fleet. They broadcast the standard transponder signals of the Empire. The fighters swarming around him matched too. TIE fighters, in their dozens. He had landed in the middle of an Imperial fleet.
"Identify yourself, unknown vessel,"
snapped a voice from the comm.
"Cease accelerating and prepare to be boarded."
Starkiller wasn't going to sit around and let his ship be taken over. He was already driving hard for the edge of the planet's shadow cone. Rogue Shadow's engines roared as the TIE fighters came about in pursuit. He frantically piloted while at the same time calculating the next jump. He hit the sun's blazing light the very instant the ship jumped. Then it was quiet again.
"I told you,"
Coda said from behind him.
"They always find us, no matter where we hide."
Starkiller turned to face him.
"Spies? Informers, traitors, lucky guesses. The Force even, if Vader is looking."
Coda fell into the co-pilot seat with a weary sigh.
His armor was marginally cleaner, but still dented and scratched beyond recognition. Nowhere safe. The ship traveled smoothly to its next destination, the empty shadow behind the second moon. There, Starkiller performed a more thorough sweep of the system. He found no signs of a prolonged space battle, which came as a relief. The rebel fleet must have moved on before the Imperials arrived, but there was no sign either of where they might have gone next. The fleet doesn't leave coordinates behind, Coda said. They could be decoded too easily. The only way to find the fleet again, once you've lost it, is to work back up through rebel contacts. That'll take too long. What's your hurry? The Empire isn't going anywhere. Starkiller didn't know how to explain. If Coda didn't already understand, maybe he never would. Instead, he closed his eyes and reached out with the Force. Juno. He could see her in his mind's eye as clearly as if she were standing before him. Blonde hair, blue eyes, strong jaw, proud nose. He would carry her face with him for the rest of his life, now that he'd escaped Darth Vader's dire influence. When they were together again, they would never be separated. It was just a matter of closing the gap between them. And what was distance but an illusion of the mind? To the Force, all things were one. Faintly he heard the rogue shadow creaking and swaying, but he didn't let himself be distracted. He was out among the stars, seeking, searching. There were quadrillions of minds in the galaxy, and he was looking for just one of them. He sensed fear and great tragedy, cruelty and petty hate. He saw death everywhere, and life too, ebbing and flowing in that eternal tide. The Force surged within him, primal, powerful, potent, like a beast, one never entirely tamed. He felt Coda next to him, full of anger and impatience. He sensed a hint of Juno flashed through his mind. I don't trust that kind of power. A lesson learned the hard way is hard, perhaps impossible to unlearn. They weren't her words, and it wasn't her voice, but she was near their source, which was itself a tantalizingly familiar presence. Water. Coda's urgency flared, pulling Starkiller out of his meditation. A dozen floating objects fell to the floor with a loud clatter. What is it? He checked the scopes for any sign of the Imperials, but they were empty. What's wrong?
I didn't say anything, said the general. Or do anything. I'm just sitting here, waiting.
There was no denying what he'd felt. Coda was impatient, and that impatience was throwing Starkiller off. You think I'm wasting my time? You don't think I can do it?
You're right on one point, boy. The galaxy is a big place, and the whole point of the Rebel Alliance is to stay hidden. But I'd never try to guess what you're capable of or not.
So you think I'm wasting my time?
I think your priorities are wrong.
Like Mon Mothma's?
Yes, exactly so. You're letting your own fears cloud your judgment.
Starkiller turned to face Coda. What do you think I'm afraid of?
Being yourself. Being Starkiller. Being Galen.
Don't say that name. I'm not him. I'm a clone, a copy, and a bad one at that.
Is that what Vader told you?
Yes.
I don't believe it.
Coda spoke with surety and great force.
No one can clone Jedi. It's never been done.
That you know of. Coda grabbed Starkiller by the shoulders.
I can sense how powerful you are. And here you are wasting it.
By rescuing you? By looking for Juno? Coda stalked to the far side of the cockpit and rubbed at his forehead with his right hand.
Listen, the Alliance leadership is deadlocked. It can't agree on our next move. We don't have the firepower to take out a meaningful Imperial target, but nobody wants to risk lives making small hit-and-run attacks either. We need to do something.
anything. We need somewhere to start.
He stopped and turned his blind gaze back onto Starkiller.
With your power, we can... No! Why not?
Juno is more important.
Why is she more important?
Because... Starkiller swallowed. He'd never admitted this to anyone. Not even Juno.
Because...
Coda waved the question away. It doesn't matter. We both know the answer. And still, I have to ask you what difference that makes.
She's one person. We're fighting an entire galaxy.
The Emperor is just one person. And so is Darth Vader. And so are all their minions. They add up, boy. But we have to defeat them one at a time.
Coda made a dismissive noise and resumed pacing. Don't try to trap me in riddles. You're no philosopher. You're a fighter like me, and you hold the fate of the Rebel Alliance in your hands.
Nobody fights the Empire and wins. You told me that once. Do you remember, Coda?
Yes, I remember.
Coda dismissed that too.
I was a different person back then.
You brought me back to myself. Back to the Force.
You showed me what was possible.
Maybe I'm really showing you now, Starkiller said. There was a very large, very complicated thought in his mind that he struggled to put into words. Maybe where we begin is as important as what we do.
You sound like a teacher I once had, and you make about as much sense as he did.
Do you think she cares one bit about that?
Starkiller hadn't considered that point. He had no idea what Juno was thinking. He couldn't even find her.
So much time had passed. He felt disconnected from everyone he had known best. Juno, Coda, even himself. He felt the world around him slipping away, as though he were becoming a ghost, insubstantial and irrelevant.
I just want...
Juno.
There was no point saying that again. Coda, listen to me. I rescued you so you could help me, but you're not helping at all. I need a place to think this through on my own, to meditate without you distracting me.
Coda stared at him, a disbelieving expression on his face.
We're at war, and you want a quiet place to think?
It's important to me to find her. I won't stop until I do.
And meanwhile, the Alliance will be destroyed. Is that what you want?
Starkiller stood, tired of being loomed over, and yelled, You talking like this is why I have to go!
Fine then. Go to the forests of Kashyyyk, or the caves of Dagobah, or wherever you think you'll find what you need. And let the galaxy die.
What are you talking about?
I'm not going to let the galaxy die. I want what she wants, what you want too, just in a different order.
Coda faced him, standing straight and tall.
Is that true?
Yes. Can I believe you? Starkiller hesitated. His feelings were muddied on everything beyond finding Juno. But he meant Coda no harm, and he was certainly no ally of Darth Vader and the Emperor.
Yes, he said. Yes, you can. I'm not a coward, Coda, and I will come back.
Coda shook his head and seemed to deflate. He looked old and tired, and for a moment, Starkiller wished he could take back everything he had said and give Coda, his mentor and friend, everything he wanted. But there was no doing that now. And it would have been a lie. Juno came first. Then the rebellion. That was how it had to be.
All right.
Coda headed toward the exit of the cockpit.
Go wherever you want. Take the ship. It's always been yours anyway. Just drop me at the nearest spaceport before you...